Welcome to the Stats Modeling the World Instructors Podcasts. 10 points in under 10 minutes. We hope you find them helpful.
Hi, this is Dick DeVoe. Today I'm going to be talking about Chapter 20, Testing Hypotheses About Proportions. Chapter 20 introduces hypothesis testing. As we look specifically at the one proportion test, we lay out a four-step plan. Hypotheses, model, mechanics, and conclusion. We discuss the meaning and proper interpretation of p-values and pay careful attention to writing conclusions. Here are 10 important points to keep in mind. 1. By now, students are familiar with the reasoning behind hypothesis tests. They have already encountered the idea of statistical significance. They know how to use normal models and understand the sampling model for sample proportions that lie at the heart of the mechanics of finding a p-value. What's new here is the formal structure of a hypothesis test. We test hypotheses in four major steps: hypotheses, model, mechanics, and conclusion. This four-step process we introduce will be the template for all the tests of hypotheses we'll encounter in the later chapters. 2. First step, the hypotheses. Write the null hypothesis. Point out that null means nothing. In other words, the null hypothesis is that nothing interesting's happening. Nothing's changed. There's nothing unusual about the results. In practice, that usually means the defendant is innocent, the medicine doesn't work, the water is not polluted, or the percentage of teens who smoke hasn't changed. We'll continue to believe that until we encounter compelling evidence to the contrary. 3. Remind students that a hypothesis is not about a statistic. It's a claim about an unknown population model parameter. So we'll never see a p-hat or a y-bar in a hypothesis. We know those values. We calculated them from the data we collected. There's no need to hypothesize about them. Hypotheses are about the unknown. 4. The alternative hypothesis represents the change or the difference that we're interested in learning about the situation. At this stage, we must decide whether we're doing a two-tailed or a one-tailed test, and if one-tailed, whether we're interested in the upper tail or the lower tail. For example, if we care about whether the percentage of teen smokers may have changed in the past 10 years, then we're equally interested in spotting an increase or a decrease, and so we do a two-tailed test. But if we wonder whether a costly anti-smoking ad campaign has had an impact, then we want to know only if the percentage has gone down. That calls for a one-tailed lower tail test. 5. Step 2. The model. We can never invoke any statistical procedure without being sure it properly fits the circumstances. So we must list the assumptions and check the conditions. Name the test. Indicate that because the conditions are satisfied, it's okay to use a normal model, and that will perform, for now, a one-proportion z-test. Each of the inference methods in the book will come with a clear name. Encourage students to learn and use them. 6. Step 3. Mechanics. Don't forget to draw a picture. A curve showing the sampling model, shading the appropriate tail, or tails, to show the region corresponding to the p-value. Calculate the value of the test statistic and find the p-value. Help students understand this p-value. It's not the probability that the null hypothesis is true. It's not even the probability that the null hypothesis is true given the results we observed. We assumed that the null hypothesis was true. We know that observed results will vary. We look at the statistics from our observed data to see if they're so bizarre that it's not reasonable to continue to believe in the model. We ask how likely we'd be to see results like this if our model was correct. That's the p-value. The probability we'd see results at least as extreme as ours if the null hypothesis were true. 7. In statistics, hypothesis testing decisions used to be based on pre-specified alpha levels or critical values of z. P-values encourage students to think more, and as a result, they understand the reasoning better. A very low p-value means our results are very unusual, and we should reject the null model. How low a p-value do we need? That's a personal decision based on the situation, the belief in the null hypothesis, and the cost of being wrong. Preset cutoffs of, say, 5% or 1% might be good rules of thumb, but remember that they're general guidelines and not ironclad laws. The modern p-value approach asks the statistician and the student to look at the p-value, think about what it says about the situation under consideration, and then make the decision. If we're checking on a sociological phenomenon of interest, say, a change in teen smoking, and we find a p-value of 0.08, we might very well say we've found some evidence of a change. But if we're testing the strength of the rivets that hold sheet metal panels in the place on the wings of an airplane we're about to board, most of us would want a very strong evidence that those rivets surpass safety specifications, and so an extremely small p-value. There's nothing magical about 0.05. 8. Step 4. The conclusion. We need to be clear how the calculated p-value led to our decision. State that decision about the null hypothesis, and then interpret that decision in the context of the original question under investigation. A complete conclusion might say something like, because p equals 0.003 is very low, I reject the null hypothesis. There's strong evidence that more than 50% of all voters favored the amendment. Or perhaps, the high p-value indicated that these results could be reasonably explained by sampling error, so I failed to reject the null hypothesis. We have no evidence of a change in the percentage of teens who smoke. 9. Help students understand that we can never accept the null hypothesis. For one thing, it's probably never true precisely. Is the probability that a coin lands heads exactly 50%? Isn't it possible that the slight bulge of Washington's head may actually affect the bounce of a quarter ever so slightly? Just because we don't find compelling evidence against the null hypothesis doesn't allow us to accept it as true. The best we can do is to not reject it. This is exactly what happens when a jury reaches a verdict of not guilty. In other words, the jury says that they did not see evidence of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury does not proclaim that the defendant has been proven innocent, and we never prove the null hypothesis. 10. Don't get sidetracked by discussions of type 1 error, type 2 error, beta, power, and so on. Yes, they're very important concepts, and we'll deal with them in the next chapter. But right now, they'll just confuse things. Concentrate on the fundamentals of hypothesis tests.
Thank you very much. This concludes our discussion. We hope you find it helpful.